Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. This particular program is going to be more packed with intelligence than most. We will be discussing in detail, a kind of tutorial really, about one of the most consequential pieces of legislation in memory. It is known by the shorthand as H.R. 1. It is the prime agenda item of Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, and Chuck Schumer has similarly taken it up. And we're going to be talking with one of the country's foremost experts about its most consequential elements involving our elections. He is Hans von Spakovsky. We call him HVS around here, but he is our duty expert on election integrity, threats to it, problems we've already had with it, notably in the last presidential race, and what the implications may be if some of the features of that race are institutionalized going forward in ways that will make almost inevitable massive fraud, well, what I call electoral grand larceny in the elections to come. Hans von Spakovsky is, of course, a highly accomplished public servant, having served in the Justice Department as a counsel to one of the assistant attorney general. He has been a member of the Federal Elections Commission, and these days he is a senior legal fellow in the Heritage Foundation's Edwin Meese Center for Legal and Judicial Studies, where he manages its election law reform initiative. Hans von Spakovsky, I could go on, but I think that's enough to get us started. Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's so good to have you.
Well, thanks for having me, Frank.
I'm especially appreciative that you're going to give us an hour of your time to really drill down on H.R. 1 and the context in which we see this being proposed. But let's talk first and foremost about that context, Hans. You warned for quite some time, indeed for years, about problems with our election systems. And I think particularly in the run-up to this particular election, we had reason to be gravely concerned. Talk a bit about how that played out as you see it, especially against the backdrop of this insistent narrative from the media, from Democratic partisans and others, that there was absolutely no election fraud whatsoever in the last presidential race.
Well, the issue there is we don't know. We don't know if it occurred or how much of it occurred, because basically everyone refused to investigate it. And what I mean by that is, look, there were all kinds of lawsuits, Frank, as you know, filed by the Trump campaign and others, submitting affidavits from witnesses, poll watchers, and others about illegal conduct, irregularities, and other things that they witnessed. But none of those lawsuits, ever, as far as I'm aware, not a single one of those lawsuits actually got to the evidentiary stage where a judge would actually hold a hearing, bring the witnesses in, and examine the claims they're being made and determine their credibility. Instead, every one of the lawsuits was apparently dismissed on procedural grounds. The judge is basically avoiding doing any kind of real investigation into all of these claims. They were dismissed on everything from the judges saying that the people bringing the claims lacked the standing to bring such a claim, to, I think, in one of the Pennsylvania cases, applying the ancient legal doctrine of latches, which is this doctrine that says, if you have a claim, you have to assert it within a reasonable amount of time. You can't wait too long to do it. And yet, and we had this judge saying that they had waited too long to bring a claim shortly after the election. I mean, it was an absurd ruling, but that's the kind of rulings we have.
Well, what's even more worrying about it, Hans, if I may, is it's not just that it was absurd, it is that it has now been greatly compounded by this false narrative that judges in 60 or so cases actually reviewed all of this evidence and rejected it. I mean, that's what we are being told endlessly, including in the course of the president's impeachment trial, are we not?
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. So, you know, the big question everyone wants to know is, was the presidential election stolen? I don't know. And I'm not sure we're ever going to know because all of the claims and the credibility of the claims was not really looked into thoroughly and investigated, which is what ought to happen. So I'm not sure we're ever going to know. But what we do know is that the many problems that we saw just exposed the many vulnerabilities in our election process, things that I've been talking about and warning about for years. And they all came to the fore in the last election. And that's why we have an obligation, state legislatures do, to try to fix those holes in the security of elections and try to make sure it doesn't happen again.
Well, let me press you on this, Hans, because I take the point that we may not have clinically determined and proven in a court of law and had affirmed by a jury or judges that fraud or misconduct or irregularities or manipulations of the voting took place. But there is a lot of smoke that all of those were operating. And I think you especially, as you say, over the years have been warning about things like mail-in ballots without justification as a vehicle for fraud. And not just you and the Mies Center and your election reform project, but even Jimmy Carter and James Baker in a bipartisan study done, when was it, back in the early 2000s, as I recall, saying this is a formula for fraud. And it seems, as again, going to the smoke, as though that was borne out by what went down in this election cycle. No?
Well, to some extent, yes. And I'll give you two quick examples. I mean, there were allegations that there were thousands of votes cast in Georgia, where, as you know, the margin of victory was very small, that there were thousands of votes cast by individuals who were still registered to vote in the state, but no longer live there. Now, as far as I'm aware, there's been no individual investigation of each of those claims on each of those voters to determine whether or not that's true. Do they still live in the state, or did they move out of state but remain registered and vote in the election? And like I said, I don't think there's been any investigation of that to determine whether it is correct. And a second, just quick example of this is, look, absentee ballots have a higher rejection rate by election officials than ballots cast in a polling place. That's because voters make mistakes. You know, they don't provide all the information. Sometimes they forget to sign the ballot, so the ballots are rejected. Think about what happened in this election, Frank. In Georgia, as in elsewhere, we had a far larger number of absentee ballots being cast by voters. And what that means is many voters were, for the first time ever, voting with an absentee ballot. Logically, you would expect the rejection rate to go up because people who've never done it before are likely to make mistakes. Instead, the rejection rate dropped dramatically in Georgia.
Hold the thought. We have to come back. We just have to take a quick break. We'll conclude that thought and the lessons we should be learning from it with Hans von Spakovsky right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are visiting with one of the country's great experts on election fraud and systems and how to avoid vulnerabilities inherent in such systems being manipulated in such a way as to affect the outcome of elections. Some of us believe that happened in this election cycle. I think all of us ought to be taking away from it that it could happen in the future if such arrangements persist. And we're going to talk about some legislation that might lock that kind of problem in. Hans is, of course, with the Heritage Foundation and has experience both on the law enforcement side as well as in the think tank world addressing these problems, and of course at the Federal Election Commission as well. So Hans, you were talking about several examples of problems that seem to have had an impact in Georgia. To the extent that that's so, was it true in the Senate runoff as well? And does this give rise to concerns about the outcome, perhaps both in November and in January?
Potentially, yes. As I said, the rejection rate of absentee ballots is normally higher than the rejection rate of ballots cast in person because voters make vague mistakes. And yet the rejection rate dropped dramatically for absentee ballots in these two, in both elections. And that doesn't make a lot of sense when you have people for the first time voting by absentee ballot. You'd expect the rejection rate to go up. And I wonder whether it can be tied directly to the fact that the state was sued by a number of liberal organizations. And the state, instead of fighting that, immediately surrendered and agreed to relax their verification process for the signatures on absentee ballots. The consent decree, the settlement agreement, made it very difficult for election officials to reject an absentee ballot if they thought the signature didn't match with the signature on file with the voter. That, I think, is an indication that ballots may have come in, fraudulent ballots that weren't actually completed and submitted by the registered voter, that were just simply accepted because it was just too difficult to reject a ballot, even when election officials suspected that it might be fraudulent.
This is the consent decree that was engineered between Stacey Abrams, who had been a candidate for governor and was, I guess, sort of heading up this effort by these leftist groups, and the Secretary of State, Rauthenberger, who went along with this without going through the full litigative process or going back to the state legislature, all of which I think, as I understand it, was problematic, shall we say, both in terms of how the process worked and how it is supposed to work. So this brings us to the present topic, Hans. We're watching a lot of controversy swirling around what happened in this election, notably in connection with the impeachment trial of Donald Trump underway at the moment. But as a professional in this space, how much of what seems to have been operating in this cycle and that you have been expressing concerns about in terms of election integrity over the years is now being baked into legislation that is, as I said, designated as HR1, the very first piece of House legislation, and S1, the very first piece of Senate legislation in this present Congress, as evidence of the priority being assigned it by the Democratic leadership in the two chambers. Give us a short course, if you would, on what these proposed legislative initiatives would do to make the kinds of things you've been worrying about law governing all elections going forward.
HR1, like I said, is probably the worst bill I've ever seen in all my years in Washington and the most dangerous. It's an 800 monstrosity. In one sentence, it is a law designed to make it easy to cheat and easy to manipulate election results. Take all the worst aspects of what happened last year and cement them into law all over the country and then make it even worse. HR1 is basically a federal takeover of the administration of elections. Elections have been administered by the states in this country since our founding. This bill would completely change that. And it's got so many bad provisions in it, I can't tell you all of them, but I'll just give you a quick sampling to show you just how bad it is. If you are a state that has wisely put in a voter ID law, and states like Texas have done that, Alabama, a host of other states, your voter ID law would now be void. You cannot require an ID for any individual coming in to vote. If you are a state that wisely requires a witness signature on an absentee ballot, you can no longer enforce that requirement. So you can't require an ID. You can't require a witness signature on an absentee ballot. And it just goes on. The law would require every state to allow same-day voter registration. That means that people can walk into a polling place on election day, register to vote, and immediately vote. The problem with that is that, of course, it gives election officials no time whatsoever to check the accuracy of the information you're providing. When you combine that with the fact that they've now outlawed voter ID, Frank, you understand what that means. It means that I could go from polling place to polling place to polling place in any jurisdiction, register to vote under a false name in each one, cast a ballot, and then move on to the next polling place. And there's nothing, absolutely nothing, election officials can do about it because of these federal requirements. It also says that every state has to allow vote harvesting. Now, if folks don't know what that means, look, in every state where you can vote with an absentee ballot, if for example, you're sick or disabled or going to be out of town election day, you can mail your ballot back. You can personally deliver it to election officials, or a member of your family can personally deliver it to election officials. But in a number of states, they have said that no one else, no third-party stranger, can deliver your ballot. That's a wise policy because otherwise, you know, candidates, campaign staffers, party activists, political consultants, people who all have a stake in the outcome of the election could show up at your front door and offer to deliver your ballot, which then puts a very valuable commodity in their hands, something that they might alter or change or decide not to deliver if they know that you routinely vote for the candidates of the other political party. So states like North Carolina have outlawed third parties picking up your ballot. Those laws would be overridden by this federal law. You have to allow vote harvesting. It's just one provision after another like that. They also restrict greatly the ability of states to clean up their voter rolls. They restrict their ability to use certain tools like the Postal Service's change of address system, which is a way that states determine if people have moved away. And they also are trying to hide information. There's a provision in there, Frank, if you can believe this, that will restrict the state from releasing any data about a non-citizen who may have tried to register to vote or who registered to vote and got away with it. Any citizenship status information can no longer be released.
I would like to drill down on that point. We're going to examine several of these in a moment. But just on this point, Hans, correct me if I'm wrong, but citizenship is the determinant of whether you are legally entitled to vote or not, isn't? And if you're not given access to information that establishes that, how on earth can you prevent, you know, the wholesale inclusion of illegal voters from participating in any given election?
Well, you can't. And I can tell you why this provision's in there. It is aimed at an organization that I'm on the board of called the Public Interest Legal Foundation. And we've embarrassed the left in a number of states and embarrassed election officials in a number of states because the Public Interest Legal Foundation has published reports on the number of non-citizens found to have been registered and voting in certain states. And they clearly don't want the Public Interest Legal Foundation did that by obtaining information from election officials. And clearly the left does not want that kind of information to be out there because, look, they, even though it's a felony violation of federal law, they want non-citizens to be able to register, to be able to vote, and to get away with it because they think it helps them on election day.
And they think that with reason. I think it's fair to say it works. Hans, we have to take a short break. And when we come back, I want to get into both some of the details of what you've just described here, but the rationale for them. I mean, how is it that people who have taken oaths of office to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States could be fashioning laws that seem so fundamentally inimical to the functioning of that Constitution and the Republic on which it is based. We'll be visiting with Hans von Spakovsky of the Mies Legal Center at the Heritage Foundation, former FEC commissioner, member of the community of serious professionals who worry about election integrity and exercise particular influence in that regard. We're delighted to have him with us to continue to explore this problematic legislation now pending in the United States House and Senate. We'll do more of that straight ahead.
More with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We are visiting with HVS, Hans von Spakovsky, a very distinguished member of a small but distinguished community of professionals who have tried for years to assure one of our most fundamental rights, and that is to free and fair elections. He has done it in the face of endless efforts by others to deny us that right. And we're talking now about legislation that might achieve that permanently. If God forbid, H.R. 1 and S. 1, the respective names or numbers of these bills in the House and Senate, come to pass as the leadership in both chambers intend. Hans, you've given us a list of horribles, I guess, as examples of the kinds of things that are in the voting reform part of this bill. And as I understand it, there are some other nasty elements of it as well. Maybe we can get to that in our last block. But just staying with the voting issues, whether you talk about these things individually or collectively, one issue that seems to arise, and we've heard a bit about it in the impeachment proceedings in the Senate, is this contention on the part of the left that every vote must count. And I'd like you just to take, as maybe a momentary digression, the opportunity to talk about the difference between every vote counting and every legal vote counting. And which are we supposed to be assuring?
We're supposed to be assuring that every American who's eligible is able to vote. But the left has made it clear they don't care about that. They want people, for example, who aren't citizens to be able to vote and to be able to get away with it, even though the law prohibits that for you from doing that. They clearly want felons to be able to vote, even though it's entirely within the power of the states to determine if and when felons will get their right to vote back. And by the way, that's graphically illustrated in H.R. 1, because in fact, there's a provision that would override all state laws on when felons get their right to vote back. And in fact, says that states would have to allow felons to vote the moment they step out of prison, even if they still have a probationary period, a parole period, or, for example, have been ordered to pay restitution to a victim and yet have not done that. And that is illustrative of the problems with this bill, but also that they just want everyone to be able to vote because they think it's going to help them win elections, even if they're not actually eligible to vote.
So this, you know, prompts the question, if we have a party in the United States that seems so indifferent to this very basic proposition that only legal votes are supposed to count and only people who are legally eligible to cast them are supposed to be able to do that in our elections. There's really no limit to the mischief that can be accomplished, and whether it's that you don't have to have a voter ID, or you don't have to be demonstrably a citizen of this country, or that your absentee ballot is authenticated by a witness, or the idea that somebody is going to harvest your ballots and turn them all in, maybe, or maybe turn in something in your name, or maybe just not turn yours in. Who knows? I mean, these are the sorts of things that go absolutely to the heart of the integrity of our election processes. And I guess it's asking the obvious here, but if the Democrats believe that anything goes, as long as it will improve their prospects for election victories, we're really watching the unraveling of our republic, are we not?
Oh, yeah, I completely agree with that. And what I've learned in 20 years now in Washington is that liberals apparently believe that the end justifies the means. And that includes in politics. And they think getting their people elected, if they have to cheat to do it, it's worth it because they need to be in control and they need to be in power. And it's a fundamental attack on the rule of law, which is a basic tenet of the way this country was founded and the way it works. And they just don't care about that.
And that's, I guess, what makes this so ominous, really, is if they can get away with it, and that's what I want to get to with you next. If they can get away with it, Hans, American voters who are legitimate, who have IDs, who are citizens, who are entitled to vote, who are voting in the right place, who are only voting once, and so on, are disenfranchised, are they not? And if that's the case, won't we assuredly see the sorts of things happening that went down in that Georgia runoff, where there was a decided suppression, not of, you know, the minority voting population and others were always told or being denied the opportunity to vote, but Republicans who simply thought, what's the point? I'm going to give this a miss if my vote is going to be either stolen or fraudulently negated.
Well, that's absolutely true. And in fact, you know, one of the reasons the Supreme Court cited when it upheld Indiana's voter ID law against challenges that was unconstitutional back in 2008, is they said that, you know, in addition to the real problem of election fraud, having a voter ID and other kind of security measures like that is essential to public confidence. Because without that public confidence, people are not going to get out and vote. And frankly, the Carter Baker Commission that you were citing to earlier said exactly the same thing, and they're right.
The courts is a subject that I want to turn to next, Hans. We're told, and I guess this example that you've just cited is relevant, where H.R. 1 clearly infringes upon the constitutional rights of states or otherwise prevents the right to voter ID statutes at the state level, as an example, which is, as you say, been constitutionally upheld by the Supreme Court. Can we have confidence that if the very troubling provisions that you've just illuminated and many others that we haven't gotten to yet were to be enacted by the Congress as a just probably a sheer power play by narrow Democratic majorities, that we'll see the Supreme Court or lower courts strike down this legislation? And can we be sanguine, therefore, that this travesty will not actually become our future lot in life?
The answer to that, unfortunately, is no. And the reason for that is that, as I said, this is an 800-page bill. It's got many, many different provisions. And while there are clearly some provisions that I think are blatantly unconstitutional, and a good example is the one we just talked about, the provision that would override state laws on when a felon gets his right to vote back, that's clearly unconstitutional. Why? Because the 14th Amendment specifically gives states the right to make that determination. And obviously, you can't override the 14th Amendment with a federal statute. That's clearly unconstitutional. But remember, the Constitution says that Congress has the ability to set the time, place, and manner of congressional elections. And while they've pretty much left that to the states for a long time, there are parts of this bill that, while they're bad, they might very well be constitutional.
So, even on a good day, when the Supreme Court actually has a conservative and originalist majority and is willing to take up a case in which there is a seemingly clear-cut constitutional problem, it takes a long time to get that done. And I guess the further complication here is, what happens in the meantime if these laws are enacted? What does that inevitably entail in terms of changes in how the states conduct themselves while some of them, at least, may be appealing the matter through the court system?
Well, I think it will lead to compromised elections, and it will also lead to something we haven't talked about because we don't have enough time to cover this whole bill. But look, there's a whole section in this bill, apart from election administration, that governs campaigning, political campaigns, political speech, that is a direct assault on the First Amendment. And that also will directly affect voters. And to give you just one quick example,
We're actually going to talk about that in a bit more length in the next block, but tee it up if you would.
Yeah, it legalizes Lois Lerner. It legalizes what Lois Lerner did in going after nonprofit organizations because they had conservative beliefs on policy issues instead of liberal beliefs.
This is the infamous IRS bureaucrat who basically made impermissible tax-deductible contributions to a large number of groups simply because, as it was subsequently established, they were conservative, sort of Tea Party-oriented entities. Hans, we have to just take a quick final break. We'll be right back with more because I think this is so critical. Free speech is under assault in so many different ways, but this is enshrining it in law if we are not careful. We'll cover that and much more with HVS, Hans von Spakovsky of the Heritage Foundation, straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back to the fourth and final installment of this extremely important, timely, and I think highly informative briefing on what we are now facing in the way of a Democratic radical left power play to permanently preclude free and fair elections in America. Our guide and briefer in this regard is Hans von Spakovsky, one of our regulars here, I'm very pleased to say, at Secure Freedom Radio, and one of the great leaders on election integrity efforts in our country. Hans, again, thank you so much for the time you've given us today, and we're really, unfortunately, even so, with a full hour at scratching the surface, but you raised before the break a whole nother set of concerns about this legislation beyond the mechanics of voting. How campaigns are allowed to operate, how people are allowed to contribute to campaigns, what kinds of things can be said in what has heretofore been considered political speech, all are now imperiled by another aspect of this H.R. 1, S.1 legislation. Walk us through that, if you would, please.
Sure. Folks may recall, as you and I discussed, that Lois Lerner, who worked at the IRS, was discriminating against organizations, nonprofit associations that were applying for tax-exempt status, not because they didn't fit all requirements for being a nonprofit association, they did, but if they had conservative positions on public policy, if they were critical of the positions of the Obama administration on everything from healthcare to immigration, she was investigating them. She was denying them tax-exempt status. She was delaying granting them tax-exempt status. And there was a huge investigation. She was forced to resign because that was a violation of federal tax law for her to be doing that. That would now be legal. H.R. 1 would allow the IRS to investigate and consider the political and policy persuasions of organizations before granting them tax-exempt status. So it's a way of using the IRS, particularly against nonprofit associations that liberals don't like and that Joe Biden and Kamala Harris don't like. And I can tell you what they would do. They would use it to go after the gun owners of America, the NRA. They would use it to go after pro-life organizations. And I can't think of anything worse than the IRS, the most powerful tax agency of the federal government, engaging in that kind of partisan enforcement of the law.
Weaponized, in other words, to advance the political warfare aims of one of the parties. And Hans, it has to be noted that even before this behavior was enshrined in federal law and made permissible by it, Lois Lerner, as I understand it, has not been punished at all for her criminal activity. Is that right?
Yeah, no, that's right. She simply resigned and is enjoying her retirement. But look, it gets worse. Look, political speech and political activity that's regulated by the federal government, particularly the Federal Election Commission, where I used to work, it covers when you're trying to promote or attack candidates for office. It is not supposed to cover grassroots activity on issues. And what I mean by that is, look, if you have a pro-life organization, or look, you have a pro-abortion organization, and they're speaking out about abortion, particularly when there's a bill in Congress that's being considered that may affect abortion, that's not political activity related to a campaign. That's working on, like I said, public policy, grassroots issues. If you now mention an elected official in any kind of communication about a public issue like that, you are considered to be engaging in campaign activity. So in other words, if there was a bill before, if there's a bill before Congress and you're an organization that's interested in that bill and you're telling people, please contact Senator so-and-so to tell them to vote against this bill because it's bad, that's now considered campaign activity, which brings you under the authority of the Federal Election Commission and requires you as a nonprofit to make all kinds of disclosures of who you're donors are. Now, the only purpose of that is so that those donors can be subjected to harassment and intimidation by making their names public. It is the modern version, Frank, of what the state of Alabama did back in the late 1950s when they were upset about the NAACP and its efforts in the civil rights area. And they passed state laws that would require the NAACP to reveal its donors. That case went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. That was struck down. But the only purpose of that state law was, like I said, to subject the donor, find out who the donors were, and to dry up support for the NAACP. This is the modern version of that.
So, Hans, when you put all this together, it clearly is aimed at both denying legitimate rights to American citizens, including the right to legal votes, determining elections, including the right to petition your government for grievances, and as I recall, a constitutional guarantee as well. The ability to, assure yourself that you're not being disenfranchised by a lot of arrangements that seem very clearly designed to do just that. So the question occurs, Hans, if the House Democrats have a majority, a narrow majority, under House rules they can pass whatever they want, if the Senate split 50-50 but has Kamala Harris in the chair as the presiding officer, giving it a 51-50 majority and can take advantage of a legislative sleight of hand, perhaps suspend the filibuster provisions, that could be sufficient to get S1 through the Senate as well, meaning that those bills would go to President Biden and presumably be signed by him. Is there anything American citizens can do now to try to prevent what would seem to be the final blow to free and fair elections and you know, contested political campaigns?
Yeah, they need to do everything they can to contact their senators and their representatives in Congress, ask them to vote against this bill. And the thing is, look, even if you have a Democrat representing you, either in the Senate or the House, you ought to talk to them about the fact that, look, even if it were, even if they like certain provisions of this bill, they ought to realize that folks in their home state should not have Washington dictating how they run their election. This bill takes that power away from them. And I would think that even state election officials who are Democrats would not want that to happen. And so I think in addition to their congressional representatives, they ought to be talking to their state legislators, because their state legislators also need to be contacting their members of Congress and saying, you should not vote for this bill, which is going to dictate to us how we run our elections and take away some of our First Amendment freedoms to speak, engage in political activity.
And our responsibilities as state legislators as well to setting certain rules for elections. Hans, this is an incredibly important topic, and I'm so appreciative of both your own expertise and your efforts to try to lead on this, often complex and poorly understood portfolio for decades now. What resources can our audience take advantage of, either your own or others, that would enable them to study up more, you know, thoroughly on this before they make these calls that I agree with you need to be urgently conducted with your representatives at both the federal and state level?
Well, if they go to the website of Heritage Foundation, or if they go to the website of Heritage Action, which is our sister organization, they can find, first of all, a very short 2-page fact sheet on H.R. 1 that lists all the bad provisions in it. Second, the other half of this we haven't really talked about is Frank, the fact that state legislatures ought to be fixing the holes in their system. We talk about this a little bit. We just put out, the Heritage Foundation, a 7-page fact sheet called Facts About Election Integrity and the Need for States to Fix Their Election Systems, which lays out the best practices for state on every aspect of elections, everything from voter registration systems to absentee ballots. And it basically is like a guide.
A how-to manual.
State laws ought to be. It is a how-to manual on how to have a good election.
Hans, we are out of time to do any kind of discussion of that. I hope you'll come back to us soon, because that's a whole nother kettle of fish, as they say, and urgently in need of attention as well. Thank you for these resources. They're invaluable. Heritage.org is how you can find it. And is it heritageaction.org is the alternative? Okay. Check all that out, please, folks, and support the great work of Hans von Spakovsky and the Edwin Meese Legal Center if you can. God bless you, my friend. Come back to us again soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.